Ekatra Podcast Conversations, for the curious essential knowledge, simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome back, everyone, to the Deep Dive. Today, we are really opening up a concept that's maybe one of the most hopeful, most empowering ideas in neuroscience today.
Yeah, it really is. We're talking about the brain's ability to change itself, its plasticity.
Exactly. And we're diving deep using the fantastic work of Moheb Kostandi as our guide here, really unpacking neuroplasticity.
And our mission, I think, for this deep dive is to challenge that old idea, you know, the one many of us probably grew up with,
right?
That your brain develops and then that's it. It's done. Hardwired.
Like a computer you can't upgrade after you buy it.
Sort of, yeah. But Kostandi argues very powerfully that the brain isn't static at all. It's dynamic. It's constantly remodeling itself, reorganizing.
And this isn't just some minor tweak happening in the background.
No, not at all. This constant change is the fundamental way we learn anything new, how we recover from injuries like stroke, how we adapt and grow throughout our entire lives. It underpins everything.
And that's the key takeaway for you listening right now. Understanding this gives you, well, incredible personal agency, doesn't it?
It really does.
It means learning that tricky new skill when you're older, bouncing back after brain trauma, even kicking a habit that feels totally baked in. It's all possible because your brain is designed to change. Your actions, what you focus on, even your environment, they literally shape the physical stuff inside your head.
It's a profound idea. And to really feel the weight of it, maybe we should look back a bit at how neuroscience used to think.
Good idea. Because for a long, long time, the opposite view held sway.
Oh, absolutely. Kostandi calls it the dogma of the fixed adult brain. It dominated the field for, gosh, almost a century.
And the big name associated with that, the person who really cemented it, was Santiago Ramón y Cajal, right? A giant in the field.
A true giant, foundational. But he looked at the complexity of the adult brain and basically concluded, okay, development's over. The power lines are laid down. No more major construction. He famously said the capacity for new nerve growth was irreversibly lost.
A finished masterpiece, maybe, but yeah. One you couldn't renovate.
Exactly. A bit bleak, wasn't it? But then the cracks started to appear in that dogma. People started thinking, well, what about activity? Does doing things change things?
And the real pivot point was Donald Hebb in 1949.
Ah, Hebb. Yes. His simple idea became, well, the mantra for modern neuroscience. Neurons that fire together wire together.
Simple phrase, huge implications.
Huge. Because it suggested learning wasn't just some abstract mental thing. It was physical. It was about strengthening the actual connections between brain cells.
Okay, so Hebb provides the theory, the how. But we need proof, yeah. Right? Actual evidence.
We did. And it came pretty quickly, actually, with people like Mark Rosenzweig. His experiments were just elegant.
The rat experiments.
Yeah, the famous rat experiments. He basically took groups of rats. Some lived pretty boring lives in, you know, standard lab cages, sterile, not much going on.
The control group.
Right, but others lived in these enriched environments. They had toys, ladders, other rats to interact with. It was like a rat playground.
Oh, what happened?
The rats from the playground, the enriched environment, their brains were physically different. Their cerebral cortices, the outer layer, were thicker. They had more complex networks, more connections between neurons.
Wow. So experience, environment.
Yeah.
It literally bulked up their brains.
Undeniably. It was concrete proof. Your environment, what you experience, physically sculpts your brain. That old dogma was starting to crumble.
Okay. So experience is the sculptor. But what's the chisel? How does this thickening, this rewiring, actually happen down at the microscopic level? Let's unpack that.
Right. So zooming way in, the action is really happening at the synapse. That tiny, tiny gap between neurons where they talk to each other using chemical signals.
The communication junction.
Exactly. And Kostandi highlights two key processes constantly happening there. They sound a bit technical, but they're crucial. Long-term potentiation, or LTP.
Okay.
And long-term depression, or LTD.
LTP and LTD. Sounds like, I don't know, stock market terms or something. Can we make that more concrete? Maybe in an analogy?
Yeah, let's try. Imagine your brain is like a huge, sprawling city, and the connections between neurons are like roads. Many start as just, say, little dirt tracks.
Okay.
LTP, long-term potentiation, is what happens when you use a specific dirt track, maybe a thought, a memory, a skill you're practicing again and again. There's lots of traffic.
Right.
So the city decides, hey, this road's important, and it paves it, makes it wider, maybe adds streetlights. It strengthens that connection. So the next time a signal needs to go down that road, it's faster, smoother, more efficient. That's LTP, strengthening connections, making learning and memory stick.
Paving the important roads. Okay, that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
But What if we only ever paved roads? Wouldn't the whole city eventually just be gridlocked with concrete? You'd have connections for everything, relevant or not.
Precisely. You need a way to clear things out, too. And that's where the counterpart comes in. LTD, long-term depression.
The cleanup crew.
Kind of, yeah. LTD is the persistent weakening of connections. It's when a road isn't used much anymore. Maybe it was important once, but not now. So the brain says, okay, let's let this one go back to being a dirt track, or maybe even let it overgrow. It prunes back or weakens the connection.
Freeing up resources.
Exactly. It clears out the clutter, makes space for new learning. You need LTD to forget the irrelevant stuff, to refine skills, to stay flexible. It's like the brain's essential delete key. Can't learn new things if you can't prune back the old.
So pave the important stuff with LTP, prune the unused stuff with LTD. That's the microscopic machinery. But how does this play out in, you know, actual human brains doing complex things, not just rats in cages?
Well, for stunning real-world proof in adults, you absolutely have to look at the London Taxi Driver study. It's a classic.
The knowledge, right. They have to memorize that insane map of London.
Insane is right. We're talking 25,000 streets, thousands of landmarks. It's a monumental feat of memory. And researchers scanned their brains.
What did they find?
They found that the posterior hippocampus, a brain region absolutely crucial for spatial navigation and memory, was significantly larger in the taxi drivers compared to control groups.
Whoa, actually bigger.
Physically bigger. And here's the kicker. The longer they'd been on the job, driving those routes day in, day out, the larger that specific part of their hippocampus was.
So it wasn't just that people with bigger hippocampi became cab drivers.
No, the evidence strongly suggested the job caused the growth. It was structural change, measurable change, happening in adult brains as a direct result of sustained mental effort and learning.
That's incredible. So if I, say, spend months learning a new language or mastering a complex piece of music, am I literally remodeling parts of my brain too?
You absolutely are. It might not be as spatially focused as the hippocampus in cabbies, but yes, the principle holds. Intense, focused learning drives physical change.
And this ties into another huge discovery too, right? Something that really put the nail in the coffin of Kajal's fixed brain idea.
Oh, definitely. The discovery of adult neurogenesis, the fact that we actually can grow new neurons, new brain cells throughout our adult lives, particularly in areas like the hippocampus.
Even when we're older.
Even when we're older. Maybe not at the rate of a child, but it happens. We're not just working with the neurons we were born with. We can make new ones. That directly contradicts Kajal's harsh decree. The brain is far more dynamic than he ever imagined.
Okay, so the brain can change, it can grow, it can learn. This all sounds fantastic, but here's where, as Kostanek points out, it gets really interesting and maybe a bit darker.
Yes, this is crucial. We've been painting plasticity as this wonderful engine for growth and learning, and it is. But the mechanism itself, LTP and LTD, it's neutral. It doesn't inherently know good from bad.
Meaning it can build bad things just as easily as good things.
Exactly. It's the double-edged sword of plasticity. The very same processes that allow you to learn piano can also wire in chronic pain or phobias or addiction. This is called maladaptive plasticity.
So the brain just strengthens whatever connections get used a lot, whether they're helpful or harmful.
Pretty much. If a circuit fires repeatedly, the brain says, okay, this seems important, and it paves that road with LTP, even if that road leads to suffering.
You mentioned chronic pain. That seems like a really stark example. How does plasticity play into that?
It's often central. Imagine you have an injury, say a back injury. Initially, pain signals are helpful, right? They tell you to protect the area.
Sure, don't move that way.
Right. But sometimes, even after the physical injury has completely healed, those pain pathways have been activated so strongly and so often that they've undergone massive LTP. They become hypersensitive, hyperexcitable.
They keep firing, even when there's no actual danger or tissue damage anymore.
Precisely. The pain becomes detached from the original injury. It's like a faulty alarm system that won't shut off. The pain itself becomes the problem, a disease of the nervous system wired in by plasticity. And treating it often involves trying to reverse that wiring using LTD principles.
Wow. And phantom limb pain. That illustrates another aspect, doesn't it? The brain's competitiveness.
Oh, absolutely. Phantom limb pain is a fascinating, if distressing, example of how brain regions compete for resources, what neuroscientists call cortical real estate.
Use it or lose it, basically.
That's the principle. When someone loses a limb, say an arm, the area of the sensory cortex that used to receive input from that arm suddenly goes quiet. No signals are coming in.
So it's like abandoned territory.
Exactly. And the brain hates wasted space. So nearby cortical maps, maybe for the face or the shoulder, start to invade that silent territory. They literally rewire and take it over.
Okay. So what happens then?
Well, now, when the person touches their face, the signals go not only to the face area of the map, but also activate those neurons that have invaded the old hand territory. And the brain interprets that as sensation, often pain, coming from the missing hand.
Because the face map annexed the hand map's land.
You got it. It's a dramatic demonstration of how dynamic and competitive brain maps are.
And the last example you mentioned was addiction. Costandi frames this not as a neural failing, but as pathological learning.
Yes, and that reframing is so important. Addiction essentially hijacks the brain's learning and reward circuits. Drugs or certain behaviors trigger huge dopamine surges, driving intense LTP in the pathways related to seeking and consuming the substance.
So it creates super strong paved highways for those addictive behaviors.
Incredibly strong. These connections become so powerful, so compulsive, that they can override rational thought, planning, consequence awareness, all the things the prefrontal cortex is supposed to handle. It's plasticity building a cage.
Okay, so plasticity can be maladaptive. It can trap us. But if it's the mechanism of change, it must also be the key to recovery, right? How do we actively guide it back towards health, especially after something major like a stroke?
Absolutely. Rehabilitation is applied neuroplasticity. After a stroke, for instance, some brain areas might be damaged, cutting off control to, say, an arm. But the brain is often capable of finding workarounds.
Finding new roads, basically.
Finding new roads or rerouting traffic. It's called functional reorganization. The brain recruits alternative neural pathways to try and restore the lost function, but it usually needs a strong push.
It won't just happen automatically.
Often not, or not fully. That's where therapies come in that really force the brain to rewire. They create a demand for change.
Like that constraint-induced movement therapy, CIMT. That sounds intense.
It is intense, but incredibly effective for many. The basic idea is you restrain the patient's unaffected, healthy limb, maybe put their good arm in a sling for most of the day.
So they can't use it.
Right, which forces them, out of sheer necessity, to try and use their affected, stroke-damaged limb for everyday tasks over and over again, intensively.
You're basically cornering the brain, aren't you? Taking away the easy option.
That's exactly it. The brain hates inefficiency. By making the good limb unavailable, you're forcing the motor cortex to pay attention to the damaged limb again to try and make it work. This intense, focused practice drives massive plastic changes, strengthening pathways, rerouting signals, often leading to significant recovery of function. You're creating a crisis that demands adaptation.
That really brings it back to agency, to action. So, okay, if we're not recovering from a major injury, but we just want to, you know, keep our brains healthy, promote positive change, how can we, in our everyday lives, actively encourage this beneficial plasticity? What are the drivers Costandi points to?
Well, there are several practical evidence-based things. Number one, maybe surprisingly for some, is physical exercise.
More than just heart health, then.
Oh, much more. Exercise directly impacts the brain. It boosts the production of crucial growth factors, especially one called BDNF, brain-derived neurotrophic factor.
BDNF, what does that do? Sounds important.
It's like high-quality fertilizer for your neurons.
Mm.
BDNF helps new neurons grow that neurogenesis we talked about, and it also strengthens the connections, the synapses, between existing neurons. It makes the brain more receptive to learning, more resilient.
So moving your body literally fertilizes your brain for growth.
That's a great way to put it. Simple, but profoundly biological. Move your body, grow your brain.
Okay, what's number two?
Number two is engaged learning. But, and this is key, it needs to involve novelty and sustained effort.
Meaning, not just doing the same crossword puzzle every day.
Exactly. Doing something you've already mastered mainly reinforces existing pathways, which is fine. But for new growth, for building new architecture, you need challenge. You need something complex and preferably novel.
Like learning a musical instrument or maybe a new language or coding.
Perfect examples. Things that really push you out of your comfort zone, that require sustained focus and force your brain to build new connections, new skills, new ways of thinking. That novelty plus effort is rocket fuel for plasticity.
So challenge builds structure. Don't just pave the old roads, build new ones.
Got it.
And the third driver.
The third is something accessible to almost everyone. Mindfulness and meditation.
Really? How does that work?
Consistent practice, like mindfulness meditation, has been shown to induce measurable structural changes in the brain.
Actual physical changes again.
Yes, particularly in areas linked to attention control, emotional regulation, and self-awareness, like parts of the prefrontal cortex. It seems that by repeatedly training your attention and observing your thoughts without judgment, you are literally strengthening the circuits that allow you to manage stress and focus better. You're exercising your attention muscles, and they get stronger.
Exercise, novel learning, mindfulness. These are tangible actions we can take.
Absolutely. They're ways to actively sculpt your own brain. So if you really boil down everything Kastandi explores, the single biggest message is probably this rejection of sort of biological determinism. Our brains aren't these fixed, hardwired machines we're stuck with.
Yikes.
They're softwired, as he puts it. Malleable, adaptable, constantly changing in response to what we do and experience right throughout our lives.
Yeah, and for me, the most powerful takeaway is how deeply personal this makes. Mm-hmm. Things like lifestyle choices. It's not just abstract advice like eat well or learn new things. Mm-hmm. It means those choices, the run you go for, the effort you put into learning Spanish, the 10 minutes of mindfulness you practice, these are active physical interventions. You are literally physically sculpting the structure and efficiency of your own brain with those actions.
That's staggering when you think about it that way.
It is. It gives us this incredible biological basis for lifelong learning and personal development. Mm-hmm. It says you can change, you can grow, no matter your age, because your brain is built for it.
Yeah.
So maybe we leave everyone with a final thought to chew on, drawing on that idea of competitive plasticity, that use it or lose it principle.
Okay.
Given that your brain circuits are always competing for resources, always being pruned or strengthened based on usage, what complex beneficial circuits are you intentionally choosing to strengthen today? And just as importantly, what old, unhelpful, maybe rigid pathways are you consciously deciding to let wither away?
A powerful question to consider.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.